Mind the gap. Stand clear of the doors, please.
In 2018, London Underground trains travel a distance that will take them to the moon and back 20 times each year, and they carry 3.5 million commuters a day. Now, new research shows us that it was the railways that made London into the city it is today. Welcome to Vox Talks, a series of conversations with the world's leading economists. My name is Tim Phillips. London was never exactly sleepy, but in 1801, only 1 million people lived there, and you could have walked across it in a couple of hours. A century later, more than 6 times as many people lived in London, and if you'd have been brave enough to walk from east to west, it would have taken you all day. But by then, of course, you could have hopped onto the Central Line instead. A new CEPR discussion paper called The Making of the Modern Metropolis, Evidence from London, by Stephen Redding, Daniel Sturm and Stefan Heblich, uses data on the growth of the railway network to explain London's growth. Steve Redding, who clearly enjoyed commuting in London so much that he moved to the US, joins us from Princeton to help us make sense of this detailed and fascinating piece of economic history. Steve, welcome to Vox Talks.
Hello, Tim. It's great to be here.
Now, your paper covers the time from the beginning of the 19th century to the early 20th century. Broadly speaking, how rapid was the change in cities at this time?
Very rapid. So in the United Kingdom, this is a time of rapid urban growth. And this is also the era of the rise of new industrial cities, such as Birmingham and Manchester. And for example, Birmingham was only around 73,000 inhabitants in 1801, and yet by 1921 it was just under 1 million inhabitants. So this is really a dramatic period of urbanization, in some ways similar to India and China, as those countries rapidly urbanize.
You focused on how trains made it possible for millions of people to commute at this time. So cities essentially divided into places where people work and places where they live, is that right?
Yes, that's what's actually really new about this period in time. So up until this point, we'd observed large cities in history. But prior to the railway, the only technology for commuting was essentially to walk or to use a horse. And horses were expensive. And so most people, particularly working people, walked to work. And what that meant is it really limited the ability for people to separate where they lived and where they worked. And that in turn had major consequences for city structure. Today, we take it for granted that you can create dense employment concentration in a business district within cities, and that you can move people's residence to a separate, largely residential neighborhood. But that was something that really only emerged in the 19th century with the invention of steam railways that made possible this first large-scale separation of where people lived and on where they worked. And that in turn made it possible for the first time in history to observe these really large urban areas with these concentrations of employment in the centre and sprawling suburbs surrounding them.
The modelling and the analysis you bring to this in the paper is extremely detailed. And when I was reading it, I was thinking, well, no one knew at the time that these day-to-day things like journeys to work and where people lived, anyone would want to measure those 200 years later. So where did you get the data for this?
Yes, we were very fortunate. So England and Wales was one of the sort of early movers in terms of collecting a population census. And so a lot of our data comes from the population censuses, which started in 1801 and then happen every decade thereafter. And one of the things that's very unusual about the population census of England and Wales is that it collects very detailed commuting data. So in 1921, it's one of the first censuses to systematically record information for each individual about where they lived and where they worked. For example, in the United States, it's not until 1960 that the population census collects any commuting data. And it's not until 1990 that it actually reports the bilateral flows of people between where they live and where they work. Yet in England and Wales, for the very first time in 1921, you have very detailed information of the flows of people between their borough of residence and their borough of workplace.
Why were they collecting this?
That's an interesting question. I think the population census as a whole goes back to the desire for people in government to understand society and society changing. So with increasing focus on public health and other concerns throughout the 19th century and people realizing that the world around them was changing very dramatically, they wanted to collect more systematic data on where people lived and what they were doing. And I think that's the sort of emergence of the early population censuses. And I think people in London realized that they were witnessing something new in history, in the sense of the emergence of this vast, sprawling metropolis in which people were commuting long distances. And so they wanted really for the first time to gather systematic data and to understand just how great was that separation of workplace and residence. And what's new about what we've been doing is that we've been bringing to bear recent theoretical innovations and improvements together with those historical data. And so it's the power of the theoretical techniques that enables us to parse the data and extract new insights from them.
The data might have been systematic, but the railway network certainly wasn't. You used to live in London yourself. And for anyone who visits London, they'll soon find out that sometimes the underground and the railway networks just seem to make no sense. And that's because they were built by entrepreneurs rather than a central planner. Does this lack of urban planning make the analysis that you've done easier or more difficult?
Yes, that's important in two dimensions. First, it's very important for us that London during the 19th century largely grew through a haphazard and organic process, which is very different, for example, from Paris, where there was a lot of central direction and central planning of the structure of the city. That matters for us because as economists, when we try to understand how the city evolved, the modeling framework we use assumes a sort of market-based economy in which individuals respond to profit incentives and individual incentives. And so it's actually an advantage of our empirical setting that London grew through this organic haphazard process where one would expect market incentives to operate. And then from a second point of view, another key part of our analysis is that we sort of explicitly take into account that railways were not constructed randomly. So if you want to think about the effect of a railway on economic activity, from a research point of view, it'd be convenient if railways were randomly assigned, because then you could just compare some locations which are randomly treated with railways to other locations which are not. However, as you pointed out, railways during this period were built by private sector companies whose stated objective was to maximize shareholder value. And so our analysis takes account of that in the sense that when we try to predict where the railway network is constructed, we don't just use the observed pattern in the data. We exploit variation in the intensity with which railways that were constructed as a result of the geographic distance between locations. And so that enables us to sort of isolate the pure parts of the railway network that are driven by this exogenous variation in geographic distance that is not affected by these profit-making incentives.
Can you explain a little bit about the modelling you did and how much of population growth and property values and commuting habits that you were able to explain using the railways?
Yes, that's another important feature of our analysis. Whenever you write down a model, you obviously have to make assumptions about the world. And one concern somebody might have is whether your model is a good approximation to reality. And so we think an advantage of our approach and our particular empirical setting is that we can actually provide a check on the model's ability to explain the data. We start with that very detailed commuting data that we have for 1921, these bilateral flows of people between the borough where they live and the borough where they work. And then we estimate the impact of the railway network on those bilateral commuting flows, using differences in physical distance and pure geographical distance. And then with those estimates in hand, we then use our model to predict what would happen to the organization of economic activity within the city going backwards in time. We car our model to match the historical data that we have on population by residence back in time and the historical data that we have on land values back in time. But we do not require our model to match the historical data that are available on the number of people who work in each borough. And so that's a very useful check, because it means after we generate the predictions from the model, we can actually go back and look at the available historical data on employment by workplace and the available historical data on commuting and check how well does the model perform. And actually, we show that our model is essentially able to explain all of the dramatic separation in the number of people who live and work in the City of London during the course of the late 19th century. And so what's distinctive about the City of London is they actually record separate data on the number of people who are present during the day, which largely includes people that are working there during the day. And so we show that over the course of the late 19th century, the number of people living in the City of London collapses from around 130,000 in 1851 to a little more than 13,000 in 1921. So a dramatic drop in the number of people living in the City of London. In contrast, there's a sharp rise in the number of people working there, such that by 1921, we have around 370,000 people commuting into the City of London. And we show that our model is sort of strikingly successful in capturing that large-scale separation between the number of people living and working in the City of London.
We should explain for people who don't live in London or are not very familiar with it that when we refer to the City of London, it's the very small historical centre of it, isn't it? You measure the population in the City of London in several layers going outwards from that.
Absolutely, I should have mentioned that. The City of London is essentially the old Roman heart of the city. Its boundaries correspond roughly to the Roman city wall, and it's the commercial centre of economic activity in the Greater London area, often referred to as a square mile. And so we use data on different parts of the modern day metropolitan area of London, which we call Greater London, and one of those parts is that old historic Roman centre in the City of London. And that's the key dramatic feature of the data we observe. We see this sharp separation between where people work and where they live. The City of London and other neighbouring areas in the centre of the Greater London area increasingly specialise as workplaces during the late 19th century, whereas the outlying parts of Greater London, the modern-day suburbs, become dense concentrations of residents who are commuting into this commercial centre right in the heart of Greater London, centred on this historical area referred to as the City of London.
Were you surprised that your model seems to have had this explanatory power, because cities are extraordinarily complicated places?
Absolutely. And one of the reasons our model is so successful is when you look at data on people commuting between where they live and where they work, you see that these commuting flows follow what economists call a gravity equation. The gravity equation is actually very simple. It relies on a kind of analogy with Newtonian physics, which is the following. When you want to predict how many people commute between locations, the idea is that the number of flows between a residence and a workplace will be roughly proportional to the sizes of that residence and that workplace, just like big bodies attract one another more intensively in Newtonian gravitation. And the commuting flows will be decreasing in the distance between that workplace and that residence. And what you find in the data for London in 1921, for the United States in the contemporary period, many other settings, is that these commuting flows very strongly follow a gravity equation. And that's essentially why our model works so well. And in fact, we show that our analysis is consistent with a whole class of different economic models that satisfy a gravity equation. And as long as a model satisfies a gravity equation, it's going to provide a good approximation to the impact of this large-scale change in commuting costs on the number of people that live and work in each location.
What would London look like today if it didn't have the railways and the underground?
That's a very important question. So another advantage of having a model is that you can really isolate one change in the economic environment. And so that's an important part of our analysis. Once we've sort of estimated our model and shown that it can explain historically what happened in the data, obviously those historical changes include many factors that could have evolved during the 19th century, including, for example, changes in productivity, the organization of production, changes in public goods and amenities. And an important feature of our baseline approach is because it uses the historical data on population and land values, it allows for all those other changes. In particular, we show that historical population and historical land values are sufficient statistics within our model for controlling for all these other changes in productivity and amenities, which is sort of an important feature and not at all obvious. But then once we've controlled for all of those other factors and shown that the model can match the historical data, as you pointed out, a key question is what would have happened if only the railway had been constructed and these other objects, namely productivity and amenities, had been held constant or had not changed over time. And so one of the things we can do using our model is answer exactly that question. And strikingly, we showed that this pure change in commuting costs, holding everything else constant, explains a lot of the rise in the separation of workplace and residence. And it explains quite a big share of the aggregate growth in Greater London. So, for example, if we just increase commuting costs by removing the entire railway network, our model predicts that commuting into the City of London in 1921 would have declined from more than 370,000 to around 58,000. If we hold everything else constant and just change commuting costs, the model implies that Greater London as a whole would have declined in population from more than 6 million to around 5 million. But of course, that's holding everything else constant. Another question you can ask is when you change the railway network, you might think that other things would react to that. We change the railway network and we use the model to explore how other aspects of economic activity might have changed. In particular, and this is clearly a feature of the historical data, when the railways were constructed, people obviously started to build taller buildings in the City of London and convert buildings from residences to office space. In the model, we can allow the supply of office space to respond to the construction of the railway network. And another insight of our analysis is that that endogenous response in the supply of floor space is very important. So, for example, once we incorporate the endogenous response in the supply of floor space to the construction of railways, we find that eliminating the entire railway network in 1921 would have reduced the size of Greater London even further to just above 3 million people. And then a very final step in the analysis is economics would suggest that the endogenous response of floor space is not going to be the only way in which the economy responds to the construction of the railway network. Another important factor that economists point to is what are termed agglomeration economies. The idea that once you concentrate employment in a dense business district, that increases the whole scale of production, and that increased scale of production is going to deliver productivity gains through knowledge spillovers, through a variety of other forces. And so economists have a good sense as to what the average magnitude of those agglomeration economies are. A central number that people point to in existing research is around 5%. So in other words, if you doubled the density of employment in a location, you'd increase productivity by around 5%. And so once we build in those standard estimates of agglomeration economies, that magnifies even more the impact of the railway network. So once you allow both the supply of floor space and productivity and amenities within the city to respond through these agglomeration forces, we find that the model predicts that removing the entire railway network in 1921 would reduce population in Greater London to just above 2 million, which is essentially explaining nearly all of the growth in Greater London over the course of the 19th century.
The railway mania of the 1840s and the 1850s famously took huge amounts of capital investment. A century and a half later, can we say that it was good value?
Yes, again, that's another important question. Another fortunate fact of looking at London and looking at the United Kingdom is that it has a very rigorous parliamentary process. So every railway that was constructed in the United Kingdom in our period was actually approved through an act of Parliament. So Parliament had to pass an act approving a railway, and there were a number of parliamentary commissions and reviews that considered the impact of railways on the economy and construction costs. And so one feature of our historical setting is we actually have detailed parliamentary reviews where people calculate construction costs for railways. And so in particular, we use the data on the capital issued to finance the construction of a railway as approved under one of these parliamentary acts. And so we can compute average construction cost per mile for overground railways and for two types of underground railways. We take those detailed historical data on construction costs, and then we compare them to what our model predicts is the impact of the railway on the value of land and buildings. And so in our framework, land and buildings are the key thing that are located specifically in Greater London. Workers are mobile between Greater London and the rest of England and Wales. And so all of this value of constructing the railway actually gets embodied in the value of land and buildings. And what we show is that when we use our model to undertake these predictions for what the pure impact of the construction of the railway would be on economic activity in Greater London, we find that the change in the value of land and buildings substantially exceeds the value of those construction costs. And of course, that's not a full cost and benefit analysis because it doesn't take into account how profitable these railways were, whether their operating profits cover their operating costs. But it does show that the impact of these railways on the value in buildings substantially exceeds those historical estimates of construction costs. And it also highlights an important point for policymakers thinking about evaluating new pieces of transport infrastructure. What our analysis highlights is there's a sort of complementarity between the value of building the transport infrastructure and the value of other buildings and capital that you might construct. And so when you build the railway, you don't just raise the value of land, you also raise the value of all these buildings that are constructed.
I've noticed you've broadened the argument around this out a little bit. Does your work capture one moment in the evolution of one city, or does it make a general point about how cities grow?
We think an important aspect of our analysis is that although London provides a very clean natural experiment to look at this major change in transport technologies, we think the insights from our analysis extend much more generally. The fact that our model explains the data in London so well and captures the systematic economic forces leads us to believe that it would also provide a reasonable approximation to other settings. So, for example, if you look at 19th century American cities, such as New York and Philadelphia, you see a very similar pattern where once you build these large-scale railway networks, you again see this pattern where residential densities start to decline. So, for example, in Manhattan, in the early decades of the 20th century, residential densities start to decline as people move out to the outer lying areas. It specializes as a workplace, just as we saw in London. These features are much more general. They apply more broadly. When you build a new piece of transport infrastructure, the economy is going to respond to that. One way the economy responds that historically has been very important is that you can separate where you live and where you work. As you mentioned, being in London every day, very striking to see the number of people commuting and often commuting large distances involving substantial costs in time and other costs. You can create these distinctive employment concentrations with new types of jobs that you couldn't sustain without that density. And then you can create nice residential areas with good schools and other amenities that people value and are willing to commute in order to benefit from.
Steve Redding, thank you.
It's been a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
A reminder that the paper's called The Making of the Modern Metropolis, Evidence from London, and it's CEPR discussion paper 13170. There is far more detail about the method, models and data in the paper than we've had time to talk about today, so I really recommend taking an hour or two to read it. This has been your weekly Vox Talk from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. Subscribe to Vox Talks on your favourite podcast platform or catch up with our back catalogue at www.voxeu.org/vox-talks.